Reform, Conservative, Orthodox? Is there one that has to come before the other?
Rather than constantly being afraid of each other, how can we actually interact with each other?
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org. ELMAD.pardes.org.
Welcome to the first live stream of this Pardes Life. This Pardes Life, for people who don't know, is a
podcast, a regular podcast, in which my name is David Levenkris, and I'm an instructor at Pardes, in which I have the privilege of interviewing other Pardes faculty, as well as people who are known in the general community, about issues which they found compelling and interesting. It's basically a fireside chat, and that's what we're going to be doing together today. I'm going to be having a chat with each of these three wonderful people on the plenum, and you'll have a chance to eavesdrop on what we're talking about. The theme in terms of Tisha B'Av is simply this. In Europe, and apparently in some places even today, there is a custom to bury the kinot in the Geniza at the end of Tisha B'Av in the hope that we won't be using the kinot again next year. Of course, what happens is that on the 8th of Av of the following year, people then have to go and take it out of the Geniza. But nevertheless, there is a minhag like that. And the idea is that we've taken three people today who are all involved in ways in which they believe they are making the world better. And in so doing, hopefully, next year we will not be commemorating Tisha B'Av, but celebrating Tisha B'Av due to the different efforts that we have. The format is as follows. First, I will chat to each of these three people. Then panelists will have an opportunity to ask other panelists questions, and then we will give it over to the floor if there's time. So, we're going to start off with Naomi Marmon-Gromit, who is the founder and director of Eden. And I'm going to go into fireside mode. Naomi, I know a little bit about it. My wife is on the board also, and I know other people. But what is Eden, and what was your impetus for finding it?
So I'm going to give you a little bit of background. I'm Naomi Marmon-Gromit. I grew up in the States. I went to Brandeis. I became interested in how does Jewish ritual and female ritual, specific ritual, impact on us today, and how do people make meaning of it? And I grew up in a home of a rabbi who was in the Air Force, and I was fairly well versed in Jewish knowledge. But when I got to be the age of 20, I said, I've learned all about Shabbat, I've learned all about Kashrut, but there's one thing that they tell me is very essential in a Jewish home that I know nothing about. Why is it that as a committed woman of 20, I know nothing about the mikvah, and yet I'm presented with it as this is going to be an essential part of your practice and commitment and identity as a woman? And so I began to study it, and I've interviewed thousands of people over the course of 20 plus years. And I heard a lot of stories when I was asking people about their experiences with mikvah. I'll share a few of them with you, and that was really the impetus for founding the Eden Center. Eden's mission is to make mikvah better, more accepting, and really a resource that everybody can access. So some of the stories that I heard, one was a woman who said, you know, I learned all about mikveh and I was excited and I went to my challah classes and it seemed like an amazing thing that could really invigorate my relationship, that could, you know, give me personal time. And then I went to the mikveh and I had this woman standing there while I was naked asking me, did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? Great, go in. And that was it. And she kind of stole the beauty right then and there. And since then, I go. I come home. I try to spend as little time as possible. And I just want to get it over with. That was the first sort of mode of story that I heard.
Naomi, I'm not 100% sure that everybody listening in knows what mikveh and Tarat HaMishpacha is. I know it's hard to do in like 3 minutes, but maybe if you would just give us some of the mechanics for maybe some of the people here or for some of the people watching on the live stream.
Okay, so the mikveh is the ritual immersion bath, which we're commanded to use it can be used in many different contexts for ritual purity. And historically, it has remained something that women do after menstruation. You count during menstruation and then 7 more days afterward. During that time, you're not supposed to engage in intimate relations with your partner. And then you go to the mikveh, and then you can resume regularly. Tarat HaMishpacha is the whole body of laws around that, which includes other things such as sleeping in separate beds in order to refrain from intimacy, perhaps not touching, and a lot of other halachot. And over the course of my research, I learned that many people keep these differently, but that's what we call the set of laws. So aside from women telling me about their positive or negative experiences in the mikveh, I also heard that when you go to the mikveh, it's a very vulnerable moment. It's a moment that you're standing in front of somebody else, but it's also you're standing with yourself. This is that time of transition in the month when you haven't been with your partner and you're about to be with your partner again. It's also the time that we're told is the most fertile in the month, where you have the most chance of becoming pregnant. And so for many, many people, these are issues and topics that they're thinking about when they go to the mikveh. Do I want to be pregnant? Do I not want to be pregnant? How is my relationship with my husband or my partner? Do I want to be with them or am I a little hesitant? Have we just had a big fight? Where am I holding in life? I spoke to one woman. I asked her about how the mikveh was, and she said, I'm not in a good place right now. Why not? She said, I just had 2 miscarriages. I don't know what will be. So who helped you with that? It's like the only one in the community who knew was the mikveh lady, because she saw me crying. And then there were the women who I asked who were like on the extreme, who said, oh, mikveh, I'm not going to the mikveh if my husband's not helping me out. I'm not going to the mikveh. If you see between child number 6 and number 4, I have a big gap. 4 and 3. Yeah, because that was when I said, I can't take the abuse anymore. And I'm not staying in this marriage. So I didn't go to the mikveh for a long time. And the other extreme of the woman who'd been married for 11 years, who probably comes to some things in Paradise, whose husband teaches sports in the community. I don't want you to think it's the wrong person, but who does all kinds of things, very active. And I said, do you enjoy your intimate life? And she said, enjoy? What does that mean? How do you enjoy this? So I said to her, but didn't you have class? Don't you know? She said, this is not something I enjoy. I do it. I go to the mikveh. And then I come home and I do what I have to do. So all of those things led me to feel that perhaps the mikveh is not fulfilling all the things that it could be and all the beauty that it could be and all that we would want from it. And therefore, Eden was created with the intention of increasing sensitivity and allowing the mikveh to facilitate positive experiences, personally, spiritual experiences, meaningful moments where somebody can encounter themselves and God in the context of an ancient tradition. We created Eden with the hope of being allowed in the community to educate about different resources, to connect people to resources about miscarriage, about intimacy, about mikveh in a broader context and women's health. And we created within Eden the concept that the mikveh in its broader iteration could be a place where we could actually catch suffering, where a woman knew that she could turn to somebody or somebody else could reach out to her and say, you don't have to be alone. You don't deserve to be alone. And it's our hope that we already have programming on the level of professionals, that we train mikvah ladies to be more sensitive, to understand what abuse is and how they can see it. We have community programming that talks about all the different levels. And we hope in Yerushalayim to be able to create a model of mikvah that really reflects all of these goals.
Thank you. You know, it's funny that, you know, you've gotten very involved in this, and yet it's also at the same time become like a really hot button topic. When I open the newspaper, whether it's about conversion or something else, I keep on reading about mikvah. Why do you think it is that it's become such a hot topic that I read about in the paper?
So mikvah is that intersection between the personal and the political. So he asked me, why is it such a hot button topic now? And it's in the paper all the time. So I really think that it's a vulnerable moment, but it's the intersection of the personal and the political. Who am I? What do I want? How do I see this within my religious life? And it's very much a question of whose autonomy is going to be to win out here. Is it a rabbi or communal person who is dictating how you're going to observe this religious precept, or you who decides and determines what will be your expression of mikvah?
Yes, I can see why that would be a hot button, because it's so much of the tension that we have at the moment is the whole tension between individual, what the community wants, what the system thinks I should do. And I'm very, very interested in hearing about Eden, but I'm interested also in here, and we've heard a little bit about what isn't so good or what is challenging. Do you have any good stories to tell about what's happening in this world outside of the work of Eden? Like, what is out there already that is good, that is helpful for women without Eden coming in yet?
Look, I think there are a lot of initiatives, and I think that more and more people are recognizing that mikvah really symbolizes the central institution for women in Judaism. And there are many other places where women are taking a stand, whether it's learning Torah or creating all kinds of, you know, the new models for women's participation. But mikvah is one of the oldest ones. And I think there are many, many efforts today which is bringing that to the fore. And I think that, thank God, today there are a lot of efforts to make mikvah more accessible to everybody, male, female, and beyond.
We often hear, and I know that one of the issues has been balaniot mikveh ladies, as they call it in English, and how sometimes they're not as sensitive as one would like them to be. I'm interested if you feel that it has to always go one way, or whether sometimes maybe women have also got to try, and who are going to the mikveh, other people going to the mikveh, need to be a little more sensitive about what's going on the other side and what might be going on in the balanit's life.
Right. So I definitely think that there's a lot of tension in how mikvah ladies see their role and how they project that. But I definitely do think there are wonderful efforts today being made for women to be able to immerse without a balanit. At the same time, I think that we really have to give a lot of respect to the women who work in the mikvah, who've really dedicated a lot of time and a lot of their heart toward this. And therefore, I do think that it's really important for women to take into account, how am I going to affect her? And what am I saying? Because today on Tisha B'Av, mikvah is a place of tolerance, of acceptance, of everybody's welcome. And the water embraces. It's an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu embracing us. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu embraces everybody. The mikvah water can embrace everybody. And that definitely goes in both directions. This week, a woman said to me, I'm pregnant, and I don't know if I'm going to go back to the mikvah after I give birth, because I'm so angry about this whole business. I want to go by myself, and that's it. I have this 80-year-old woman in my yeshuv, and I don't want to go back to that. And I said, maybe you could say it to her differently. She's doing what she believes is the right thing. And maybe you could say, I would really like to have a few minutes by myself. Would that be okay? Would it be okay if I, however she wants to end the sentence, but creating that ni'imut in both directions is critical when we continue forward in making mikveh more accessible.
You mentioned that the mikveh is a little bit of a place of self-acceptance or a place where other people accept you. You mentioned Tisha B'Av. We sometimes think of the third temple on Tisha B'Av. The ideal world is going to be created. What would your ideal mikveh look like? And what would your ideal mikveh experience look like? Just dream a little.
I dream every single day. So, in the ideal mikveh experience, I think that I'm going to speak about women because that's really the tchum that I feel more passionate about. But that the mikveh feels like a place that everybody can have their moment, that you can go and really feel that acceptance and feel that the water is open to you and that whatever you want to offer, it has something to offer you back. I hope that in the next year we will really see mikveh ladies. Eden's education is about expanding what the mikveh lady knows about. She knows how to identify abuse. She knows how to react to somebody who's gone through a miscarriage. She knows how to look at a woman who's had a mastectomy and make her feel welcome. And I really hope that as we go through the year, we'll be able to educate everybody on both sides that feeling of embrace can be a reality.
One last question. You're making me want to go to the mikveh. I've only been once in my life and it did nothing for me. So it's really, you're actually the first person who got me excited about it. Tell me, I can hear the wonderful work you're doing. We spoke about, special things we're going to do this year to make the world less of a Tisha B'Av world. You're already doing amazing stuff. How are you going to push yourself this year? How are you going to go beyond your confines and your comfort levels this year in terms of your work with the mikveh and in terms of bringing about the ultimate mikveh?
That's a good question. look, I think one of the ways, which I think is not just an Eretz Yisrael-centered question, I think that we need to have a lot more connection with all parts of the Jewish community, and I think that's pushing to the next level. I think that one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is how men should really be involved in that picture. And I said before,
I said stretch you, not stretch me.
No, but that is stretching. But we need to be inclusive of the other voice. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're going to try to work with.
Thank you very, very much. There will be a chance later, people, for us to ask more questions to Naomi. Naomi, when she mentioned, she said men, women, and other genders, or you didn't say those exact words. What?
And beyond.
And beyond. Men, women, and beyond. And then and now, there was a certain amount of laughter in the room, but it's a very, very real issue. Many of us may be ourselves identifying that way, or may know people who are gay, lesbian, or bisexual, but nowadays there's a much, much longer acronym that people speak about, and that is LGBTQ+. Nachama Goldman Barish, who is next going to do the fireside chat with me, is somebody who's very, very involved in this issue. Before I even ask you how you got involved in this issue, could you educate me and the rest of us a little bit, exactly what do these different acronyms LGBTQ+ stand for? What does it mean? It's a short, easy question to start off with.
Okay, so first of all, I want to thank Naomi because I'm a graduate of one of the Eden courses, the Advanced Bride Teaching class, and she's doing great work. And I'll say, Naomi, that I insist the Chatan and Kala, the bride and groom, both of them come to pre-wedding classes. And I say to the men, the days of waiting for your wife to do everything she has to do during the days after her period till she gets to the mikvah and waiting at the top of the steps with a big smile saying, honey, so good to see you because now we're permitted to each other. That's over and no longer accepted. And men really have to figure out how they can complement the role of the woman given that they can't actually do the halachot for her. And I challenge them. And so hopefully I'm not the only one, but thank you for the work. I'm a proud graduate of Eden and a colleague, and I teach in some of the courses Eden gives. I have to be honest, the queue is still a little baffling to me, but and because I haven't, you know, it's a relatively new, the idea of, for me, a little bit using the language queer when I'm not gay feels a little bit like using the N-word because I'm not black, meaning there's language you grow up being told is very inappropriate, and then certain communities take the language back or the terminology back and subvert it or reuse it for themselves. And so I'm going to start with the LGBT. So lesbian, gay, bi, and trans. And I'll say that, since David's already turning to me and I'm a Pardes faculty member and I've been teaching, really what got me into the conversation were the voices of students that I've taught over the last 10 to 15 years. Obviously lesbian and gay refers to both gay men and women, but largely with LGB, we're talking about gay women, gay men. That's the acronym. And then bi are people who are bisexual, who on the spectrum are attracted to both genders. T is trans, and what's fascinating about trans and what really is creating a lot of awareness in America, the conversation about bathrooms and what bathrooms people whose gender does not match their biology should use. Huge question. We here have gender neutral bathrooms, to address that issue. But trans has become interesting because this summer I have a wonderful student who identifies as gender fluid. So normally, what we normally think of transgender, transsexual, are people who don't identify with the gender they were born into. And so I've met actually even young children like this, but certainly adults who were born female, but from a very young age, sometimes as early as 4 or 5 years old, feel that they're in the wrong gender, sometimes even earlier. Meaning I've heard the stories of even at two years old, children already correcting their parents, really feel that they've been born into the wrong gender, or someone born biologically male who feels like a female from a very young age, and really the conflict and the challenge and the suffering until they're able to acknowledge or express or have that validated. I have not really a colleague, but a woman I met in Sweden, a psychiatrist, who's the head of the transsexual unit in the hospital, main hospital in Stockholm, and they have, I think, over 200 men and women waiting for sexual reassignment surgery, so every so often I check in with her to ask my questions. What a Pardes student this summer exposed the faculty to is this idea that, okay, maybe we've gotten used to the idea of transgender, I feel like I'm in the wrong gender, but gender fluid, this idea that I'm not sure what gender I am, that really blows the binary out of the water. And I'll talk a little bit about how Judaism is really going to have to struggle, because Judaism is a very binary religion, as many religions are. And what do we do if you don't define yourself as male or female, or if you're no longer male or no longer female? And so, again, I'm far from being the expert on all issues having to do with transgender or transsexual, but it does fit on this spectrum of gender fluidity and sometimes choosing the opposite gender. And from what I understand, queer is just the umbrella. I think it's the umbrella. I don't even want to answer because I'm not going to give the right answer. I didn't look up properly how to define that. Okay. Questioning. Okay. But I think when they refer to it, they do use queer, but queer is questioning which fluidity or which gender, which sexuality. Okay, thank you.
So you said that you you got into it because of students.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested, you know, lots of students come with lots of different issues to teachers, and for you it's just become like somewhat of a passion. I'm interested about, on a personal level, what attracted you to be interested in this issue rather than other issues that students might come up with that have to do with different things in their lives.
Okay, so I think my earliest memory, I was trying to figure out where it started, because I don't have any gay family members, and so it didn't, or trans family members that I know of, right? Although at this point, I'm so open with being open that I think people would come and talk to me. At least I hope so. So it didn't start from a place within the family, but I remember in the 80s, and so I'm already dating myself, but going back about 30 years, reading an article of a rabbi who the AIDS virus was beginning to really smite the gay community, the gay male community, and rabbis writing kind of treatises saying this is God's wrath being unleashed on Sodom and Amorah, and feeling, wait a minute, that's not my God, and that's not my religion, and that's not how I look at it. And that was even before I got into this conversation. So I think, before I personally became part of this conversation. And I think over the years, being open to listen to, gathering stories, you know, the YU student who had gone to a prominent Hesder Yeshiva was a prominent YU student who came out as gay also in the late 80s, and kind of the shocked silence and the burying of the story, and no one would even mention his name. The truth is, it took me about 15 years to figure out who it was, because no one would actually say the name. They would just refer to the story as if you knew, you knew, but if you didn't, we're not going to tell you who it is. I think those stories really began to settle within me, so that I guess I've been at Pardes about 10 years. When I began to have students who began to come and talk to me about some of the challenges about being gay and religious or gay and Jewish, I was ready to hear them. And when Beit Hillel, I belong to a rabbinic organization called Beit Hillel, and I looked back in my email. 4 years ago, it took 4 years for them to put out a position paper. I mean, that's how sensitive they understood the topic was. But already when Beit Hillel began examining the issue and the fact that there were three or four, I think at that point already four religious gay organizations, and every yeshiva was, you know, having to confront the fact that they had gay students. And so Beit Hillel said, well, where are we going to be and what are we going to do? It was clear that I was on the left of the spectrum, meaning I was already in a place where I was empathetic, I was sympathetic, I have a tremendous respect for the halachic system, and in the last 4 years gained even more, so I understood its limitations and that religion has limitations as well. On the other hand, my definition of where the slippery slope was, and you'll ask me the next question and I'll get to that, is very different than I think other people's definition of slippery slope. And so in the conversations, I was always I would be the one to say, okay, I know there's a prohibition, but okay, so what? What's the next piece in the conversation? And so I also think you saw in the email exchanges the difference between rabbinic leaders and educators who had gay students or family members and those who was all theoretical. And so really they were just kind of reading from the text what they were supposed to say without really feeling.
So you you almost asked yourself the next question.
Yes,
so I'm sort of interested in two scenarios in a way. One is if you're speaking to a parent or to a LGBTQ student, what might happen in that conversation? And I'm interested, almost like in the comics when they do the backdrop, what is going on in your head? You know, Leviticus 18:22 exists. It's a prohibition in the Torah. I'm interested in, on the one hand, what you're saying, and on the other hand, what's going on in your head as a Jew who defines herself as observant, maybe Orthodox, certainly part of a system in which certain homosexual behavior is prohibited de rita, other is rabbinically prohibited, and lesbian sex is frowned upon at the least.
Oh, okay. So David, you've given me the opening I was trying to figure out how to open up with. I will say, I have so much to say, and you're going to have to give me my 1 minute warning. I will say that it was a little jarring. I grew up with this idea that male homosexuality, wow, that's like abomination, super prohibited, and so on. But lesbian relations, well, you know, it's frowned upon. And the truth is, if you open up the halachic literature, it's pretty much prohibited, meaning, and quite definitively, and rabbinically, okay, and we like to distinguish between rabbinic and biblical, although we frown on both. And I thought it was interesting. It seemed to me to reflect a kind of homophobia towards male homosexual relations and a somewhat of a tolerance, a shrug towards female lesbian relations, that the patriarchal society is kind of like, okay, we're willing to put up with this and absolutely not put up with that. Even though, again, both are prohibited, and we don't normally go around saying rabbinic prohibitions are okay. And so I think it's interesting that that religious conversation often is almost dismissive of the prohibition of lesbians, as if, well, that's not really a big deal, and women are very affectionate and touchy anyway, and so that's okay. And male homosexual, a particular type of male homosexual relations are very prohibited. And so, I think religion as a whole has a very hard time with homosexuality because it goes against a lot of what they, you know, the whole procreation thing and the binary and the family that they believe needs to be created. And so there's a tremendous struggle in religion, not just in Judaism, in all Western religions. I don't want to go to the Eastern religions to kind of figure out what their position is and how to address some of the serious questions homosexuality and LGBT presents to religious dialogue and religious meaning. That said, you asked me about parents and about students, and it's really two different conversations. I have had parents. Again, it's at this point probably going to make a difference if it's traditional parents, religious parents, or non-religious, because of course the conservative and reform movements have made tremendous, I don't know if you want to call it progress, but their attitude towards the whole LGBT conversation is about 30 years of progress in thinking through the issues and coming up with not just a tolerant policy, but an accepting policy. And orthodoxy isn't there. We're working on tolerance right now, I would say. And so with parents, I have to acknowledge the tremendous pain that having a child who is choosing a different path, a path that conflicts with religious belief, deep foundational religious belief presents. And so the fact that I personally may have come to a different conclusion or a different place, I try not to bring that in when I talk to parents. I do acknowledge and validate the pain and the struggle and how difficult this is for them, and try to suggest different resources. Because I think one of the biggest problems today is the feeling of being alone. You talked a little bit about it with the mikvah. It's very hard for a parent who has a child who's gay or trans to come and talk to anyone. And if you go to the wrong person, then the damage that can be done is astonishing. And so you have to find the right pastoral counseling, not to mention therapist and therapeutic counseling and so on and so forth, to help, you know, help process and resolve the issues. When I talk to students, or young adults or adults who are questioning or seeking some sort of counseling, then I'm in a different place and with different, you know, different resources. I haven't yet had anyone come to me as they're trying to deliberate whether they're gay or not, I have to admit. The students or people that I talk to are already fairly confident of what their sexual identity is. And then I have to say, this is where I perhaps, again, put myself on the left of the spectrum, if there is a spectrum of in the religious conversation, where I'm not going to apologize for the prohibition and I'm not going to rewrite prohibitions, but to me they're besides the point in the conversations I have with the gay, you know, with gay students, in that I talked about the slippery slope. Everyone's afraid if you're too tolerant and too lenient and too loving and too accepting, then people who are on the fence, and that's where the bi question comes in, everyone's afraid that the bisexuals who could be heterosexual are going to jump towards homosexuality if you give them a hand or a shoulder to lean on. That's really one of the biggest concerns in moderate orthodoxy today. And I say, well, what about the other slippery slope, which is, I don't have to tell people here, the suicide rate among gay teens, gay young adults, is 2 to 3 times, gay and trans, is 2 to 3 times that of regular teens. In the Orthodox community or the religious community, tremendous depression, self-loathing, disgust, feelings of being abandoned, exiled, excluded. What about that slippery slope? And what about the fact that I don't want, you know, my students, my members of my community to feel they have to go to the promiscuous life that so many think gay culture represents, when they really want to have monogamous, consensual, loving families with children, with spouses, and so on and so forth. And so I'm more in a place of educating towards using the values that we so cherish and treasure and incorporating them into sexuality that, again, I'm not going to ignore the fact there are prohibitions involved. And so some of my colleagues are saying, you can't sanctify prohibitions. And I'll say, look, I think you can sanctify or create, strong Jewish identity and strong commitment, even from that, you know, from that place of outside the box, if you will.
So I'll give you a little challenge from the other side. Yes. When you were just speaking now, you said gay, trans teenagers as compared to regular teenagers. Mm-hmm. There are some people who say that gay and trans teenagers are regular teenagers.
Okay.
And that we,
yes.
What about people who are calling for a world in which really all sexuality is sanctified and all is seen as part of a grand orchestra of different, grand salad, if you will. Use whichever metaphor you will. And we'll look at your kinder, gentler orthodoxy as being hopelessly caught in a binary. What would you say to that person?
I mean, I would say to some degree they're correct, that I am, still as a traditional person who is respectful and trying to work within a traditional system, I am going to be somewhat dated. I'm going to end up having to hold in one hand my commitment to Torah and Halacha and Mitzvot, and in the other hand, my commitment to Western, the morality that I've grown up with. And they don't always synthesize, meaning I think, again, that's part of the challenge, that we tend to think, well, if it's in the Torah, then it's moral. And I would throw out there that I don't think that's always the case. I don't think that it always goes together. I think there are things in the Torah that force us to question sometimes immorality that may appear. And I'm not specifically talking about LGBTs. I'm talking about other things in the Torah that force us to question moral or immoral things that we're asked to do. And so living with a cognitive dissonance, this understanding that I can't make everything work, that I can't make everything synthesize, but I have to do the best that I can with where I am in progressing on both fronts. And now I've lost my train of thought. David? Yes?
Last question. Same as Naomi's. How are you going to stretch yourself even further this year to help bring a less Tisha B'Av world?
Okay, so what I'd really like to do is education, education, education. I think that one of the things tonight, actually, for the first time in our community, I'm putting together a session on, from an educational therapeutic standpoint for parents in the community, or adults in the community, or young adults in the community, on the topic of LGBT. And that's been a big step forward, that within my community, I'm going to talk, again, trying to let people realize they're not alone and there are many resources they have they may not be aware of. I'd like to change the constant two things. Pedophilia. I really find it offensive when people say to me, well, pedophiles have to control themselves, so why can't gays? I want to change that kind of attitude, or the comparing to sins. Well, you mean it's like someone who doesn't keep Shabbat or someone who doesn't like keep Nida? I'd like I want to stop the silence or the ignoring. I want to stop some of the radical conversation, preferably on both ends of the spectrum, both from both my community and other communities. And I'd like there to be just more of containment, if there will, containment and understanding.
Thank you very much, Nechama. You mentioned your community, where, of course, you live in Elazar.
Yes.
Which is in Yehuda. And we're actually going to move to something very different now. I wanted us to have really lots and lots of different topics, because everybody thinks of the world and the perfect world and the reperfected world in all different ways. And I asked Meir to come in, who, like Nechama, teaches at Pardes. I think he's the longest standing teacher at Pardes. And I remember visiting you when I was a Pardes student. I remember a very, very pleasant Shabbat with you in Har Nof. And then a few years later, I remember you upped and went to live in Efrat. What was your impulse for moving to Efrat?
Okay, I'd like to say that the only connection between the topics is that we are neighbors and where we are. I made Aliyah in 1972. When I made Aliyah, my intent was to study in Yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion. And that was actually my first exposure to, I guess you'd say, living across the Green Line, to being in a settlement. You might even say that I kind of fell into it. But I would say that that year, I actually fell in love with the area where we lived. And not only that, but I perhaps developed, you might say, a theology, ideology of why I wanted to live across the Green Line. Probably the thing which made the greatest impact on me was the feeling that I am actually living the Tanakh. I am living what was a significant part of Jewish history. And therefore, where I am, I can say very definitively, this is certainly the area of the patriarchs, which I teach quite a bit at Pardes. This is not only the area of the patriarchs, this is where Jews were living in terms of the First Temple period, okay, and during the Second Temple period. And that the feeling that I am now part of that historical continuity was something that was actually very, very special to me. For a lot of what you might say practical reasons, I decided to move to Jerusalem, and at one point I was in Har Nof. Probably a major reason was the fact that my parents, my mother-in-law, were living in Israel, living in Jerusalem. We wanted to be close to them. In 1993, my mother-in-law unfortunately passed away, and it actually presented an opportunity for my wife and I to actually actualize what had been our dream for many, many years, to move across the Green Line. For those of you who may be familiar, 1993 was also when the Oslo Accords were being put into place. And for me, there is a certain aspect of my personality, which is what you call a dafka, Nick, that dafka, when Oslo was being put into place and when many of the people were in a state of concern, what's going to happen with the settlements, and many people were actually seriously thinking of maybe leaving, I said that what I would like to do is to actually go and settle. And to actually, I think it's, you know, very appropriate on the day of Tisha B'Av, when you talk about Chorban, you talk about destruction. And then there's a question, a famous story with Rabbi Akiva, when he sees the temple in a state of desolation and everybody's crying, and Rabbi Akiva says, but you know what? I can see beyond that. I can actually see that, in fact, in the same way that this prophecy was fulfilled, so the other prophecy will also be fulfilled, that eventually, right, little kids and old people will be sitting in the streets of Jerusalem. So that was my feeling. Everybody is seeing that this is pretty much the end of what was known as the settlement movement, and I wanted to show that I believe now that the settlements really continue to be here, which was my motivation for actually moving to Efrat. I would just say that among my considerations to come to Efrat, maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit afterwards, is that it's close to Jerusalem, which meant that I actually was in access of being able to come to Pardes. And probably another aspect was the communities. And I think maybe I'll just say that right now, that my experience has been that in many of the settlements which I am familiar with, many of the people are attracted because of what they feel, the quality of life, where quality of life is not just a question of being able to get more affordable housing, but quality of life is being able to be in a community with people who you feel are actually trying to build something, where it isn't just a question of everybody having their own little nest, but the idea that we can actually try to build model communities. And for me, I think that's something which is also a very important part of what exists today.
You speak about model communities, but very, very often these communities have entrance requirements, or socioeconomically are only open to certain people, or certain of the difficult challenges of the cities are not available here. What do you do with the challenge? People would say it's very easy to build little model communities when everybody's like you, share certain basic values in a comparatively homogenous world in which you don't have to deal with many of the challenges of living in a society where there is more diversity.
Well, Rav Kook has actually a very interesting idea in terms of, you know, how you develop relationships. And, you know, there's the idea that, you know, you start with the most intimate relationships that you have. And then what you do is you expand beyond that, with the idea being that ultimately your goal is to be able to create the most comprehensive relationships you possibly can. I'm actually a very firm believer of that. And I would say that, I mean, if I take, you know, the community that we live in, I think contrary to what, you know, many people believe, yes, the communities are within a certain spectrum homogeneous, but I would say that there still is a very real diversity among the people living in the communities. I would also say that certainly in the circles where I operate, the overwhelming majority of the children of our communities all go into the Israeli army, and not only that, but when their reason for going into the Israeli army is not only to serve the country, but to actually become part of that diversified community so that, in other words, I can speak for myself. I have 9 children. I have 6 sons. 4 of them are officers. In fact, one is a Skanaluf, a lieutenant colonel. All of them specifically went into combat units where they would be with a whole spectrum of Jews that are, and to actually experience what you would call the diversity of the Israeli population. I think, in fact, the army is actually a very important place to be able to have that sense of, you know, the diversity of the community. In fact, what I would say is that maybe having grown up where they grew up, they actually were able to bring something to that diversity and to impact on it. I would also like to add another thing, which is, I'm sure it's going to come up at some point, that we obviously do not live in a bubble, but we are surrounded by an Arab population. And I would say that I also think one of the things which is very interesting by living where I am is that I probably have more interaction with an Arab population for a variety of reasons than, you know, people who are living in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, or I could pick a whole other number of areas. And in that sense, it's also given me the ability to actually get to know Arabs and to be able to interact with them, and maybe even more important on another level, to also have them get to know Jews on a first-hand basis.
Nevertheless, the Arab neighbors who you interact with have a very different set of rights and privileges to the one that you do. You have all the privileges and rights, perhaps even more, of a citizen of the State of Israel, whereas they would claim that they did not. I'm interested how you balance, you know, the very idealism, the Zionism, the living where the patriarchs are, with living amongst people who have a very, very different set of rights that you do.
I'm glad that you asked me this question, David. I think that's a very, very serious question. That's definitely a tension that I live with. Okay, what I would say is, for me, first and foremost, what's important to me is that both myself and the people that surround me, the people that, since I'm an educator, the people that I educate, how do they treat the people that they come in contact with? And, you know, a lot of times we throw out the concept of, you know, human rights and morality. I'm a firm believer that, you know, that a lot of times that can be a lot of empty slogans. And the question becomes, how is that actually played out on a very real day-to-day basis? Okay, I had, when I moved to my most recent apartment in Efrat, we were doing renovations. I had an Arab builder who was from Hebron, who did the renovations for me. I can honestly say that we actually developed a very, very good relationship. Okay, I don't know how much I'd say a very close relationship, but certainly a very good relationship of mutual respect. I'll even give you one anecdote. We had someone who's an electrician who lives in El Arub, which is a refugee camp, which is not necessarily considered to be one of the more, how should I put it, friendly places. This person is an exceptional electrician. When the time came to give me my bill, and I actually had, you know, one of my friends to give me some sort of rough estimate, what should it cost me? He charged me half of what he should have charged me. And I looked at him and I said, Tayir, I said, what are you doing? Like, you know, it should be a lot more money. So what he said to me, which I felt was a very powerful statement, he said, you treated me with a lot of respect. Because you treated me with a lot of respect, so I want to also show you that I really value that, and I treat you with respect. And as a result of that, yes, this is what I'm charging you, as an expression of my gratitude to you. Now, I have to say that afterwards, there were a few times when I got him to do stuff, and he refused to charge me anything until I threatened him that I would never have him do anything for me again, because I didn't want him to be able to work for free. But the point which I want to make is that, in other words, this for me is how you begin to build, okay, relationships. This is how you begin to really show that you value the other, okay, and treat them with the same dignity. And to me, that's what it's all about. Rather than speaking in a very amorphous way about rights, to actually speak about it, how do you treat the other with the utmost dignity?
There are people who say that the time on the two-state solution, which is the best solution for Israel and the Palestinians, is running out, and that, you know, with all due respect to your nice stories, that in reality, putting more money into the settlements is a waste of Israeli money, and building the settlements is preventing a negotiated settlement. I'm interested, and that's not just a theoretical issue. It's, you know, it's an attack or a challenge which some people will make to people like you who live in the territories. How would you respond to somebody who called you an obstacle for peace?
Okay, David, I get the hardest questions here. Okay, the first thing which I'd like to say is make it a little bit controversial. After I moved into Efrat, one of the things, especially during the Rabin administration, that I found extremely offensive was a certain what I would call demonization of the settlers. In fact, what I would say is that I always tell people, I always found it a joke, maybe a very sick joke, that Yasser Arafat was given the Nobel Peace Prize and was considered to be the person who was promoting, right, coexistence, whereas I, Meir Schweiger, am considered to be the obstacle to peace. I, Meir Schweiger, who when I moved into Efrat, my wife forced me to buy a gun because she said, you know, you have to have something, God forbid, and unfortunately, it was the reality for a number of years where you travel on the roads and you have shootings and everything, still is today with stabbings, where you at least have to be able to protect yourself. In 22 years living in Efrat, I can tell you I can count on my fingers the number of times I walk around with a gun, and if anybody wants to check me, you can see right now. So that's a little bit ironic that I, right, who, because I am a settler, by definition, am a warmonger, am a hostile individual who's just looking for blood, I don't believe that. And I would also add that I don't think that the settlements are the obstacle to peace. I think the obstacle to peace is the inability to be able to actually recognize the mutual rights of each other. And to me, in my thinking, in other words, there will absolutely not be any peace in the same way that I am willing to recognize the rights of the Palestinians to live where they are. And I certainly am not saying, let us remove the Palestinians from Yehuda v'Shomron. In the same way, and I will say this, for me, it is painful to see mosques on the Temple Mount. For me, the Temple Mount is where the temple was and where I believe the temple will be. And yet, nevertheless, I acknowledge there is a mosque. And I acknowledge the fact that I'm not going to blow up that mosque, and that in whatever solution we come to, then we have to somehow allow for the what we would call freedom of prayer for everyone on the Temple Mount, certainly in the immediate future. But I think there has to be mutuality. To me, it is totally unacceptable that I, as a Jew, should not be able to go on the Temple Mount and to be able to pray. Okay? That is not freedom of religion. It is totally unacceptable that I should not be able to go to any Jewish site that happens to be in a Palestinian town. And until that is something, by the way, I'll just say that my builder, who I said to you was from Hebron, the only fight that we actually had one time wasn't even a fight. It was like you could see he was very uncomfortable. Was when he had brought my wife 10 samples from his factory of floor tiles, and my wife didn't like them. So I had to convince him that this is just a question of taste. There's nothing more to it than that, and that what can we do? Everybody has their own taste. You know, it's not personal. And then half-jokingly, I said to him, I said, but maybe if we would actually come to your factory in Hebron, she would have thousands of samples to choose from, and then, you know, I'm sure she would pick one of them. And that was the only time when he actually got very, very serious, and he said to me, I wish you could. But he said, I can't guarantee your safety. And then he went into a whole discussion where he said, you know, 25 years ago, I can actually go through all of Efrat, and not only Efrat, but Alon Shvut and certain other communities in this area, and I can show you all the buildings that I built. And he said, 25 years ago, I was able to go freely into every Jewish community, and you Jews could come freely to my house, and I had loads of Israelis who would come to visit me. But that's not the reality now. And that's something which is sad. Sad for you and sad for me. And so what I'm saying is that, in other words, there has to become a situation where there is that mutuality. And what I would add is that, in other words, for me, rather than the settlements being an obstacle to peace, the settlements can actually become a bridgehead for coexistence. And that more could be done in terms of being able on the ground to create a sense of how can we actually work together? How can we cooperate together? For those people who are not familiar with, in my area in Gush Etzion, so we have a Rami Levi supermarket, which is probably in certain ways a model of coexistence, where not only do you have Jews and Arabs who are working together, but Jews and Arabs who shop together, okay, and where on principle Rami Levi was actually insistent that he wanted that to be, and I think it actually can become a model of how, rather than constantly being afraid of each other, how can we actually interact with each other.
Thank you, Mayor. We're now going to take questions from other panelists and from the floor. And then what we'll do is we'll take a few questions, and then each person will answer the questions that are sent. And then one question that I have for both Nechama and Mayor is whether saying that you live in tension is really a cop-out, whether saying you live in a tension between Arab rights and your rights, that's a tension for you is really a cop-out for not dealing. And similarly for Nechama, whether saying you live in a tension between your liberal humanistic rights and your halakhic rights is just not a cop-out for pushing one of them as far as you can. So that's my question. Naomi, what questions do you have for the other panelists?
For Nechama, I wanted to ask you, why do you think that within the Orthodox community, these issues are now, I mean, they came to the fore 30 years ago and, let's say, 4 years ago on Beit Hillel. Why are people really only dealing with them now and willing to address them now?
We're going to take a few questions and then answer them.
And I guess on Tisha B'Av, one of the last things that you said sort of resonates with me, and that is the question of coexistence. Certainly in the mikveh realm, there's been a lot in the news about reform conservative versus Orthodox rights, and you're talking about coexistence of Arabs and Jews, and is there one that has to come before the other?
Okay, so Naomi, I would say...
asking Naomi a question now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm asking her question. I'm asking her a question. I would say, first of all, I know you were very aware of the fight of Tenu Lit Bol B'Sheket, let women immerse alone. We let women go to the mikveh alone in my yeshuv already for a while, but women in Jerusalem wanted the right to be able to go without a mikveh attendant. I know that some sort of decision was made to allow that. I wanted to know if in practice, if you know, it really is being upheld. And number two, how prevalent is mikveh outside of Orthodoxy, meaning how successful has Tzohar or the rabbinate been in introducing the idea of mikveh, and how many women who, you know, you get that idea. And Mayor, this is something I struggle with a little bit. What do you do when you have students who won't come out to you because you live over the green line? How do you personally and then as an educator handle that? I find that difficult.
Mary, do you have questions for the...
Do I have the questions for Naomi? Since you said that till you were 20, this is one area that was completely removed from your awareness. So what would you say about having, for example, Jewish women who are not married getting an awareness of the mikveh, okay, even going to the mikveh, okay? And in terms of Nechama, so the...
how far...
What?
Just say it.
What would be your vision for the Orthodox community, okay, as to how far they should go in being accepting of the LGBT community?
Okay, we're going to take a few questions from the floor. A question, by the way. A question is not your opinion, at which at the end you raise your voice as if you're asking a question. A question is a question that comes out of genuine. That's my job. I'm allowed to do that. But a question comes out of genuine curiosity to learn something from something that one of the speakers have said.
This question could be for anybody, but as a lover of the Torah and the Talmud, and it has been my experience that it is the mission of Jewish people to understand and interpret the Torah to create a very beautiful halachic system. So I just wonder, with regard to the issue of people who are LGBT or many other issues in the Torah that could be found offensive to Western sensibilities, why we don't see it as our mission to interpret things in the spirit of the Talmud and change them. Like, I don't know, I'm just going to give an example so you know what I'm talking about. Like writing Ben Sora Mora out of existence, or Heter Iska, or like 100 million other things. Is that not the spirit of Judaism? Are we afraid because we wrote the Talmud down? How would you address that?
You had mentioned, you touched on the controversy with Orthodox conservative reform as far as mikveh. Is there some sort of hope that you have of whether it's creating additional mikvot for use for, you know, the Jewish people without question to what movement they're in? That's A. And then B, are you hopeful that the rather than the rabbinate having control of mikveh, that maybe the Jewish people can have control of the mikveh?
I wanted to know if there are actually specific guidelines today for the people that are running the mikvahs, for the mikveh ladies, because it goes far beyond what many people perceive as extremely patronizing and destroys their experience of just seeing whether her head goes underneath the water or not, and how, according to the Torah, it's okay for her husband to trust her, but suddenly the mikveh lady doesn't have to trust her. I don't really get that. But it goes beyond that. And in terms of, like, my own wife has commented of the fact that the mikveh lady is staring at her long before she even goes into the mikveh, which is far beyond the bounds of where she needs to be. And I'd just like to know, are there guidelines actually in place for these people? Who are these people that are actually there? Do they receive any sort of guidelines whatsoever? And at what point is it actually defined that they've crossed a line and something is inappropriate and it's worthwhile for somebody to actually complain about it? And at what point is it within the realms of what they're supposed to be doing?
Naomi?
In terms of your question about a mikveh for the Jewish people, that's really Eden's vision. There's nobody who needs to ask you. You and you with yourself, your partner, and God need to decide if you need to use the mikveh. And if you do, the mikveh accepts you. One person's immersion does not have any effect on the next person's immersion. The mikveh is a place of tahara. And if somebody enters the mikveh, that does not in any way, shape, or form affect the next person. And therefore, that is completely the vision, that mikveh should be a place where we don't ask anybody, are you single, married, divorced, gay, lesbian, it doesn't matter what, the mikveh is there for all of us. And it's a shame that what has essentially taken place in Israel is the politics of who controls the mikveh has obviated that reality. I think there are many people today who understand that we need to work toward a vision that way. In terms of who gives the guidelines, so today, that's largely a question of what Moetzah Dati, what religious council is in charge, how they see it, what their outlook is, meaning in Gush Etzion, the religious council understands the needs of the local residents as much more open, and therefore in Elazar, women can already immerse alone without a mikveh lady because the head of the religious council says, okay, the halacha sees that as a possibility, and therefore that's fine. Part of our job as Eden is to say exactly what you said. Hello, who trained your mikveh ladies? How are they? Where? Why are they not sensitive to different women's needs? And one of the things that we do, for example, is try to help mikveh ladies understand their role as less controlling a woman's immersion, right? She's responsible for herself. Nobody went and pulled that woman off the street and said, come You must immerse right now, except when they have to do it before they get married, in which case there needs to be a lot of acceptance and openness about that, too, because women are coming because they have to come. But nobody's, in general, nobody's pulling a woman off the street and saying, you must immerse. So she's there because she wants to be there, and she wants to fulfill what she believes is called for, and therefore, part of our mission is to help mikvah ladies understand that tension. You're telling her what she has to do, but she knows what she wants to do and what she has to do. And therefore, you have to respect her. That it all goes back to respect, respecting of each other. And we are trying to help create guidelines, but we're also trying to help create a reality in which the mikvah ladies understand their job, as I said, not as I control your immersion, but rather, since I'm there, if I see that something is wrong, I can reach out my hand. I know how to identify the signs of abuse, not so that I can be yet another abusive person in your life and tell you how to do things, but rather so that when I notice something, I notice you're not going home. I notice that you have a handprint on your back, which somebody, you know, one of the mikvah ladies told me, then I can reach out to you and I can say, is everything okay? I really want to be here for you. I'm an ear to talk to if you need. And that's a wholly different experience. It's a wholly different experience of immersion.
And that was very powerful for her as a young girl to know all that. And she didn't quite understand what they were talking about, but she knew it was around intimacy in the mikvah. And so she grew up, and I think you're right, Naomi, I'm saying that. Is this working now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You asked me why now. If you watch a movie called Trembling Before God, which I believe came out in 2001, the difference between what went on, I mean, that was a big deal when that movie came out. In terms of critical mass, there weren't a lot of people self-identifying as Orthodox and gay. Largely, they were leaving Orthodoxy. And so I think in the last 15 years, what's happened, at least in Israel, and again, I know their HL is doing tremendous work in America, so I know there are facts on the ground there as well, but there are at least four, if I'm not mistaken, five Orthodox organizations that are working with lesbian, gay, bis, and trans. And that says it all. I mean, I'll just quote Nadav Schwartz, who started Shoval. He said, look, we don't need you, meaning we've created our communities without you. It is not an oxymoron to be religious and gay. And we are creating communities and synagogues and family structures. If you want to be part of our conversation, obviously, we would much rather have that kind of inclusion. But my colleague, Hannah Friedman, Dr. Hannah Friedman, who lives in Tel Aviv, she and her husband are the rabbinic leaders in a shul that has a lot of gay families. And in the last year, 11 of them had children. Meaning, so the facts on the ground, Naomi, is that just, again, everyone's growing up a little more, and this claiming our place in religious society. And so it's still super painful for the yeshivas, for the communities, for the families. But at the end of the day, it's here. And so what are we going to do? Where are we going to find ourselves? Are we going to continue to ignore or deny or reject? Or are we going to say, look, halakha has to, or the religious conversation has to at least acknowledge and be empathetic and tolerate. And then the question is, can we go further? And Mayor asked me, what's my vision for the Orthodox community? How far to go in acceptance? Wow, that's a really important question. And we're barely ready to ask that question. I'll say it's really going to depend on, is the acceptance on the family level, on the community level, on the national level. As I said, there are shuls already that are very accepting, that do have kiddushes when there's a marriage or a birth. But not everyone's ready for that. And I don't think everyone has, there's no uniform answer. I think that the most important step is probably for families, because that's where the most damage can be done, and that's where there's this tremendous need to still be loved and accepted and included. I think communities like, I mean, Mayor and I both live in the Gush. The Gush is a place where many young adults have become have left Orthodoxy, have gone off the derech. And every community had a struggle with, are we going to let our kids come home on Shabbos or leave on Shabbos. Because basically the kids were saying, well, if we can't come and go on Shabbos, we're just not going to come home. And parents ultimately found that to be unacceptable. And I know at least one community that said, look, our kids are going to drive in and out. You want them to park right inside. They were parking outside the gate and all their cars were getting stolen. So that wasn't really a great solution. I know with us as well, people will park inside the gate so that they can get in and out comfortably. Now, again, it doesn't matter what the numbers are, how many and so on. It was families saying, look, we want our kids to come home on Shabbos. We want them to come at least for a meal. And if we coerce them, then we're going to lose them. And so I think a similar model has to be found, but I don't think there's one answer. I just think that people have to start listening to each other. Families have to listen to their children. Rabbis have to listen to their students. And ultimately from there, perhaps we can move forward. And I just want to address what Mia said. Why don't we interpret things as the Talmud did? And I think Mayer is going to answer it as well. Look, the Talmud was 2,000 years ago. There's been a tremendous ongoing legal conversation since then. I'm going to use a very imperfect analogy, the Constitution. It's amazing to me after reading the Constitution that anyone still takes that seriously and that remains at the foundation. Maybe that's heretical for the Americans among us. But so much of the Constitution seems so irrelevant and outdated. And really, it was written 300 years ago by a bunch of men. And how could they possibly have anticipated the world that we live in today? And yet, no one's throwing out the Constitution. They're adding addendums to it. They're reinterpreting it, right? It still remains very much at the core of American constitutional law. And I would say here we have the Talmud, which is religious law. So much more ancient, much more grounded, much more reflective of an entire belief system, not to mention the Torah at its center and so on and so forth. So I process and precedent, meaning that's part of this ongoing legal conversation. I would rather see the halachic process start in a less loaded place, if you will. I want answers and halachic guidelines to what happens if I have a transsexual. Where do they sit in shul? Meaning, what do they do if they're already transitioned? At what side of the mechitza, which I heard actually someone ask, or by Rafi Feuerstein at a panel discussion sponsored by Bach Kol at Hartman. And it was a trans man. And he, without blinking, said, you sit in the men's section. Meaning, we need rabbis to be able to answer questions, or halachic authorities. What do I do if I'm gay and I'm in a male yeshiva? Do I have a room? Can I have a roommate? Can I use the showers? Meaning, what do I do with negiah and yichud, with touching someone of the same sex, or being alone with someone of the same sex? Meaning, what are my answers there? And if I am going to be in a gay relationship, then where are the red lines of do'raita and do'rabanan? So that's where I'd like to see the halachic conversation start, like at least practically, which is what we're so good at, practical guidelines. But to do that, we have to acknowledge that that this exists and tolerate, and then move on.
In terms of the question that Naomi asked me, so I would just like to say that David purposely did not ask me the question, like, what's your vision and what are you planning to do in terms of settlements for the next year? And he was told not to. And I think part of the reason why I told him not to was because exactly of your question. Because especially on a day like Tisha B'Av, my feeling is, that's my agenda. My agenda is to first promote coexistence between Jews and then secondly between Jews and Arabs. And therefore, I mean, I've devoted my life. I've been at Pardes for the last 38 years, basically being involved in teaching, right, Jews of all stripes and being able to try to create better understanding between different types of Jews. And my sense is that it becomes extremely important for us to understand who we are as a Jewish people and to have a sense of where we're going. And after that becomes clarified, to then be able to engage the Arab population. But I think that we have to first look within ourselves. So that's the first thing. Second thing, tension. I don't think tension is a cop-out. In fact, I think that as somebody who's been studying Talmud all my life, the whole thrust of Talmud is to be able to see the complexities of situations, to be able to see that there are many different dimensions to it, and to learn to live with complexity. I'd even add, when you asked me the question about two-state solution, one-state solution, I said one of the things which you learn from the Talmud is that sometimes there are certain questions which don't necessarily have an answer. And yet you go on, you go to the next page, and you say to yourself, just because I don't have an immediate answer to that question, that doesn't mean that life falls apart. And I think that's part of what a Talmudic experience, and I would even say an important educational experience, is to be able to see the complexities and to see the nuances. Which leads me into what you asked me, Nechama. When I have a student who says, well, I'm really sorry, but I can't come to your house because you live over the green line, I find that extremely problematic. And I'll just tell you a short story. I told you that I studied in the yeshiva, Yeshivat Har Etzion, and many people may here know the Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Lichtenstein, who was my teacher even in America before he made Aliyah. And there was one time in my life where I actually saw him getting irritated. And the one time was when we had a teacher-student engagement and asked the rabbi anything you want, and I asked them a question. And the question that I asked them was, you, as the head of the yeshiva, right, which is in the West Bank, how do you, who ostensibly is somebody who is so concerned with morality and ethics, justify being the head of a yeshiva on the West Bank? And then I said, and I'll add, because I have students who refuse because of moral issues to travel across the Green Line, right, where it's Jewish settlements across the Green Line, not, okay? So, Rav Lichten, it was the only time I ever saw him being absolutely furious. And he got angry because he said to me, he said, in no way do I identify with your students, say. Yes, I think that, in other words, for the sake of peace, we should be able to find solutions, right, in order for Jews and Arabs to live together. I believe passionately, and anybody who knew Rav Lichtenstein knew that, passionately in morality, in human dignity, in human rights. But I also believe passionately in the right of Jews to settle anywhere in the land of Israel. And until we come up with a solution to that, then yes, we should continue to settle in those places. And that's Rav Lichtenstein, who in my mind was the model educator of what nuance and complexity and seeing the broader picture is all about. Therefore, what I would say is my job, and that's what I see my job in Pardes, is to educate. And when I want to educate my students, it's towards seeing that. And I want my students to learn, you don't have to agree with me. You don't have to believe now, oh yes, settlements are wonderful. But before you make a statement about that, go and see a settlement. Go and experience what it's like. Go and learn about it, which doesn't mean that you just go to a settlement. Go to Arab towns, go wherever you want, but get to see the whole picture. But for a student to say a priori, no, I will not go there, then it means that you are basically putting on a pedestal ignorance and intolerance. And that's something which I cannot accept as an educator. The last thing which I want to say in terms of the question of halachic change is that halakha is a system, and I think you spoke about the American judicial system, but I think any type of legal system, by definition, is conservative with a little c. And the assumption was that whoever set up the system, if it's really a substantial system, there was logic to it. There is some truth to it. And as a result of that, the question becomes, and not only that, especially if you're talking about the Jewish legal system, the Jewish legal system is, depending on how you want to count, but in other words, it's something that's existed for thousands of years, which means that there is truth to it. Now, its strength is that, yes, it evolves, it changes. That's the essence of what Torah Shebaal Peh, what the oral law. That's why there's an oral law in addition to a written law. But change is something which doesn't happen overnight. And we live in a reality where everything is now. We're the now generation. I shouldn't say speak about me, because I'm already old, okay? But I would the millennials, they are the now generation. We want things now. We want everything to change now. But that's something which is very, very unhealthy. That's something which is very, very unstable. If people want to make changes that are going to be sustained, that's something that has to be evolutionary. It happens. It has to happen over a period of time. That's why what Nechama said, which I agree with, is that let's start dealing with the things that are maybe the easier issues to deal with, and let's try to get that become integrated into the system. Once that becomes integrated, then it will be a natural and an evolutionary part of an evolutionary process to move on to the next issue. But people have to be able to have patience. And for those of you who have been living in Israel, savlanut is a central word, and it's very Jewish. On that note, I would say maybe that's not only Savlanut, but Sovlanut is the theme of Tisha B'Av.
Thank you very much to our panelists. In a few minutes, we will have a short memorial to our four students who were killed in terror attacks, which is this day, is every year is in their honor. And then there will be the movie with Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardoza and a chance to ask Rabbi Cardoza some questions afterwards. So we'll have a little break now and then the memorial.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, ELMAD.pardes.org.